I love the little Peanuts cartoon in which Linus is eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, we would say jam, and as he's eating, he notices his hands, and he says with an air of profundity, "Hands are fascinating things. I like my hands. I have neat hands. My hands have a lot of character. These hands," he says, "will someday do marvelous works. They may build bridges or heal the sick or write soul-stirring novels or score home runs." Then, as he reaches a crescendo, he says, "These are the hands that will someday change the world and change the course of history." And Lucy looks at those hands and rather matter-of-factly says, "Hands covered in peanut butter and jelly." Well, that was the lesson that I needed to learn last year, that God uses hands covered in peanut butter and jelly. I went through a bit of a crisis in which I lost confidence in preaching, not confidence in preaching per se, but confidence in my own preaching. I just felt I wasn't particularly good at it, and it was, don't over-exaggerate it, because it was a private struggle. I continued to preach on, but it was a struggle to get in to the pulpit, and just feeling very, very inadequate. And after you listen to this sermon, you may be tempted to agree, but please don't tell me. I have enough struggles with myself. But there are some men, you see, and they just love preaching, don't they? They're in love with preaching. Well, that's not me. I temperamentally find preaching difficult. It's not something that I'm naturally drawn to. It's something I do because I believe God has called me to do it, and I hope in some measure has gifted me for. And in moving to a larger and more demanding church, the pastoral pressures, I think, resulted in this loss of confidence in my own ability to preach, or at least to preach well. But it was this discovery or rediscovery that God uses hands covered in peanut butter and jelly that restored confidence in preaching. Now, you'll be glad to know that that wasn't drawn from the Peanuts comic strip, that lesson, but rediscovered from the book of 2 Corinthians. And it's that book that I want to turn you to just now. And I want us to read from 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 16. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 16. "I repeat, let no one take me for a fool. But if you do, then receive me just as you would a fool, so that I may do a little boasting. In this self-confident boasting, I am not talking as the Lord would, but as a fool. Since many are boasting in the way the world does, I too will boast. You gladly put up with fools, since you are so wise. In fact, you even put up with anyone who enslaves you or exploits you or takes advantage of you or pushes himself forward or slaps you in the face. To my shame, I admit that we were too weak for that. What anyone else dares to boast about, I'm speaking as a fool, I also dare to boast about. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they Abraham's descendants? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I'm out of my mind to talk like this. I am more. I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, and been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger in the sea, and in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Who is weak? I do not feel weak. Who is led into sin, and I do not inwardly burn. If I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weaknesses. The God and Father of the Lord Jesus, who is to be praised forever, knows that I am not lying. In Damascus, the governor under King Aretas had the city of the Damascenes guarded in order to arrest me. But I was lowered in a basket from a window in the wall and slipped through his hands. I must go on boasting, although there is nothing to be gained. I will go on to visions and revelations from the Lord. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether it was in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know, but God knows, was caught up to paradise. He heard inexpressible things, things that man is not permitted to tell. I will boast about a man like that, but I will not boast about myself except about my weaknesses. Even if I should choose to boast, I would not be a fool because I would be speaking the truth. But I refrain so that no one will think more of me than is warranted by what I do or say. To keep me from being conceited because of these surpassing great revelations, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Amen. Humility, said Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, is the chief of all Christian graces. It is the hallmark of the true child of God. And humility, of course, is the opposite to pride and its fruit of boasting. In fact, the dictionary defines boasting as being excessively proud of one's possessions, skills, or superior qualities. Boasting is the very antithesis of humility. And remembering that quote from Lloyd-Jones is therefore incompatible with true biblical Christianity and a true profession of faith. But in this passage, that's exactly what Paul does. He boasts. He uses the word boast or boasting some 16 times. In verse 16, he speaks of engaging in a little boasting. In verse 18, he says, "I too will boast." In verse 21, he says, "I also dare to boast." And right into chapter 12, we find Paul boasting again and again. And it's surprising and a little shocking to find the great apostle engaging in such a thing, it seems absolutely incongruous that Paul would resort to such an unspiritual and clearly an unbiblical activity. And of course it is, unless we understand what Paul is doing in this passage. So with that in mind, we want to look at Paul's boasting. And I want you, first of all, to notice the reluctance in his boasting. As we come to this passage, described by John MacArthur as the most emotionally charged passage that Paul ever penned, we need to understand that boasting isn't something that came naturally to him. These are uncomfortable words for him to write. He doesn't find it easy to talk about himself. He reluctantly engages in these things and brags about his own experience. And he says 3 things about boasting. First of all, he says it's foolish. Look at verse 16. "I repeat, let no one take me for a fool. But if you do, then receive me just as you would a fool, so that I may do a little boasting." Paul, in order to make a point, adopts the posture of a fool. The word fool there means to be without reason or common sense. And boasting is the product and the fruit of a foolish mind. Boasting is foolish, he says. Secondly, boasting is unspiritual. Look at verse 17. "In this confident boasting, I am not talking as the Lord would talk, but as a fool." Paul says that by engaging in this boasting, I'm not doing what the Lord would have done. Although no one ever made higher claims for himself than Jesus, He uttered those claims in the context of the self-emptied son bent on the business of pouring out his blood for the redemption of men and women. His life on earth was characterized by self-denial and great humility. And since Jesus was and Jesus is the embodiment of all that it means to be holy, and that he is the model, therefore, that we must emulate and the pattern that we must follow, then to boast is a very unlike Jesus thing to do. It's a very unspiritual thing to do. So he says that this boasting is foolish, it's unspiritual, and then worldly. Verse 18, since many are boasting in the way the world does, I too will boast. Boasting is the fruit of worldliness. It's what the world does. It's what the world did then, and it's what the world does now. In Greek and Roman antiquity, boasting was a great thing. Ancient monuments and public buildings were peppered with inscriptions recording the accomplishments of those that they honored. Even in private homes, on walls, there were murals or frescoes were hung that listed the accomplishments of the head of the family. And today it's no different. Much of our entertainment is based not on the talent of the individual, but on a parading of their ego and aggressive self-promotion. And celebrities will sink to the gutter using offensive language and engaging in obscene behavior in order to set themselves forth. In the business and academic world, candidates are expected to sell themselves with professionally produced CVs that maximize the most trivial of accomplishments. That's the way of the world, says Paul. Boasting is worldly. Boasting, he says, is foolish, it's unspiritual, and it's worldly. And yet this is what Paul does. He boasts. The reluctance in his boasting. He wants us to understand that he's doing this reluctantly. Secondly, the necessity of his boasting. If Paul viewed boasting as foolish, unspiritual, and worldly, why do we find him doing it in this passage? And the simple answer is needs must. The church at Corinth was at a crossroads. It was in danger of ceasing to be a true church and of squandering the true gospel. And so Paul employs what Margaret Thatcher would have called a short, sharp shock to wake them up and to expose to them the danger they were in. And so he adopts the tactics of his enemies and boasts just as they would have boasted in order to gain the church's attention. Look at what he says there in verse 18. Since many are boasting in the way the world does, I too will boast. Now, the many there were a group of Johnny-come-latelys who had infiltrated the church at Corinth and were selling themselves as super apostles. And they boasted of their superior gifts, their superior knowledge, their superior experience, even their superior looks. And Paul, well, Paul, they said, was, well, he had no personality, he had no authority, he had no dignity, he had no ability, he was that little old bandy-legged apostle with a hooked nose who couldn't string two words together. And it seems the church was torn in their loyalty and love. Many were being won over by these people who seemed to have so much more to offer. Paul says rather sarcastically in verse 19, you gladly put up with fools since you are so wise. It was a serious business because these imposters were fools, not simply fools in terms of common sense, but fools spiritually speaking, in terms of lacking spiritual understanding, in the sense of Psalm 19, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. In verse 20, Paul gives a scathing description of these false apostles. He says in verse 20, in fact, you even put up with anyone who enslaves you or exploits you or takes advantage of you or pushes himself forward or slaps you in the face. He says they enslaved, they brought the Corinthians into bondage. They exploited, literally, they devoured them. They fleeced the flock. They ate them out of house and home. They took advantage of them. That word means to be caught in a trap. They ensnared them. They pushed themselves forward. The ESV translates it, they put on airs and graces. And finally, they struck them in the face, which was probably a metaphor for insulting them. Now, if we were looking for one word to sum up those five characteristics, we would say that these false apostles were abusive. They enslaved them, they insulted them, they exploited them, they treated them with utter contempt. And strangely, the Corinthians accepted, not only accepted that abusive behavior, but were drawn to that authoritarian leadership. Verse 19, you gladly put up with fools, gladly put up with fools, since you are so wise. Verse 21, to my shame, I admit that we were too weak for that. There was something of the masochist in the heart of these Corinthians. They loved being enslaved, exploited, and taken advantage of by these charismatic figures who oozed an air of confidence and had an air of authority about them. And of course, that doesn't surprise us, because even today, people are still drawn and taken in by abusive authoritarian leaders with big personalities who make big demands and expect great or big sacrifices from vulnerable people who attach themselves to them. One thinks of Jim Jones, who persuaded 909 of his followers in 1978 to drink poisoned communion wine and commit mass suicide. I just don't know how they get away with it. I have trouble getting them to drink ordinary communion wine on a regular basis. But there is something in some people that allows them to be abused and manipulated by authoritarian figures. But it was even more dangerous than abusive leadership. These false apostles not only took advantage, but they propagated poison. Right at the top of that list, in verse 20, we're told that they enslaved. The AV says they brought into bondage. Now, Paul uses that word only in one other place in the New Testament, where he speaks of the Judaizers in Galatians 2 and verse 4. He says, this matter arose because some false brothers had infiltrated our ranks to spy on our freedom and to make us slaves. That's the same word. Anyone who enslaves you. It seems that these super apostles not only made extravagant claims about their ministry, but also denied the very gospel of God by adding to grace law as a condition for salvation. Notice how Paul stresses his Jewishness in verse 22. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they Abraham's descendants? So am I. Linguistically, culturally, and religiously, Paul was a Jew, but he was a New Testament Jew, just as Abraham was an Old Testament Christian who believed that salvation came by grace alone, through faith alone. And so he adopts the posture of a fool to warn and to wake up these Corinthians to the danger that they were in. He resorts to drastic tactics because the very gospel was at stake among these Corinthians whom he loved. The necessity of his boasting. The reluctance in his boasting. He says boasting is foolish, unspiritual, and worldly. The necessity of his boasting. The Corinthians were in great danger. The third thing I want you to notice is the content of his boasting. What does Paul actually boast about? Well, in verses 23 to 29, we have this great list where Paul catalogues his achievements. And the list can be grouped into four. First of all, he boasts of the effort that he made in verse 23. Are they servants of Christ? I'm out of my mind to talk like this. I am more. I have worked much harder. Paul was the kind of man who made you tired looking at him. He was industrious, productive, hardworking. In Acts 19 and 20, he gives us an insight into his ministry during his stay in Ephesus. He preached every Sabbath in the synagogue. He lectured every day in the hall of Tyrannus. He visited publicly from house to house. He planted other churches. And added to that, he labored to support himself in ministry by tent making. No one could question his commitment to the work. So he boasts of the effort he made. Secondly, he boasts of the persecutions he experienced. Look at verse 23. I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, and been exposed to death again and again. Five times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I remember Paul is in Ephesus when he wrote 2 Corinthians. So this is up to and including verse 1 of Acts chapter 20. So these things that are mentioned are for the most part not recorded in the book of Acts. He speaks of being in prison. One early church father says that he was in prison seven times. Five times he received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one. The Mosaic law forbid more than 40 lashes at any one time, so they stopped short at 39, 26 administered to the back and 13 to the chest. And it wasn't unknown for someone to die under such a beating. Five times, pre-Acts 20, Paul received those lashes. That's 195 stripes. Three times he was beaten with rods. That was the Roman equivalent to the Jewish lashing. In theory, as a Roman citizen, he should never have been punished in that way, which explains the alarm of the magistrates, you remember, in Philippi when they discovered that he and Silas were Roman citizens. Once he was stoned. That's at Lystra in Acts 14, where you remember he was dragged outside the city and left for dead. Three times he was shipwrecked and spent a night and a day bobbing about in the open sea. Now, when you add all that together, that's 12 near-death experiences, all pre-Acts 20. Calvin says these persecutions were his first apprenticeship because there was more, much more to follow. His body became a living monument to his suffering. So he boasts. He boasts of the effort he made, the persecutions he experienced, and then thirdly, the hardships he faced in verses 26 and 27. I've been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Here Paul lists the hardships that he faced as an itinerant preacher and church planter. He was constantly on the move, crossing into new territories and establishing new frontiers. In the book of Acts alone, it has been estimated that he traveled 5,580 miles. On these journeys, there were rivers to cross and seas to sail. There was the constant threat that faced every traveler in those days, the danger of bandits. He faced opposition from Jews and Gentiles. He knew what it was to go without sleep, to go without food, and even, it seems, to go without clothes. He knew what it was to be criticized, ostracized, and scandalized by false brothers. His life was a life of constant hardship, always on the move, always on the run, always under pressure. It was a life of hardship and difficulty. It was a life that was lived on the knife edge. It was a life in which he constantly put his life on the line. Paul's boasting. The efforts he made, the persecutions he experienced, the hardships he faced. And then lastly, the burdens he carried. Look at verses 28 and 29. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Who is weak and I do not feel weak? Who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn? The phrase besides everything else or apart from other things, as the ESV translates it, is a phrase which means apart from the things that I haven't mentioned. Chrysostom believe that Paul even here didn't tell half of what he suffered in the pre-Acts 20 period. He was constantly under pressure. But now he speaks of not so much external pressures, but internal pressures, pastoral pressures, emotional pressures. And of course, that was the greatest burden of all. He felt keenly the weakness of the church and the weakness of others. When someone was weak, he was weak. His heart was tender. He knew what it was to feel pain for others. Years ago, there's a senior pastor who visited the Irish Baptist College, and one of the students asked him, what did he feel were the three most essential qualities for a pastor? And I think he was quoting somebody else, but he replied, the mind of a scholar, the heart of a lion, and the hind of a rhinoceros. Now, it sounds good, but I don't think he's right. I don't think he's right. Empathy is that ability to feel the pain of others. I love the little story about the mother who was a bit distressed about her daughter who hadn't come in from playing with her friend out in the street. And eventually when she came in, her mother, with a mixture of anger and relief, said to her, where have you been? And she said, well, I was out playing with Alice. Alice fell off her bike. She cut her knee. She skinned her elbow. She broke her doll. The chain came off her bicycle. And she was crying. Well, why did that keep you late? Demanded the mother. And she says, well, I just sat at the edge of the road and helped her cry. Well, that's empathy. That's Paul. Paul was a big softy. You know that daring use, of the feminine in 1 Thessalonians 2 when he says, we were gentle among you as a mother cares for her children. Then at the end of verse 29, he says, who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn? When a professing Christian fell into sin, it had a profound, a consuming effect upon him. He was indignant, he was hurt, he was grieved, he was wounded. All those emotions were burning in his heart. He was no dispassionate, detached, disinterested doctor who could switch off his mobile phone along with his emotions at night and just get on with his day. He felt these things keenly in his heart. You know, I've been in the ministry now almost 30 years. I started as a child. You just have to remember that. But 30 years. And nothing surprises me. Absolutely nothing surprises me. But it should. Just before I came away, I was called out to the home of a Christian family. Don't attend our church, but too embarrassed to go to their own minister. And their 35-year-old daughter, who was mollycoddled from a child, innocent, naive, was seduced by a predatory lesbian on the internet who has now convinced her that she is gay. And those parents were heartbroken. I felt I was just a little too matter-of-fact about it, because nothing surprises me. But it should. It should. It should wound me. It should distress me. It should perplex me. Paul says in verse 26, I face the pressure daily of my concern for all the churches. And of course, that was something that the Greeks particularly disdained. The great thing in Stoic philosophy was to be hard and detached and impervious to suffering, yours or anybody else's. The story's told of the Stoic student who is out playing in the field with a little fox cub, and he sees two of his teachers approaching, and for fear of appearing effeminate in the presence of his teachers, he tucks the little fox cub under his tunic. And the fox cub then begins to gnaw at his flesh, eats through the flesh and into his insides, into his guts. And there he stands resolutely, unflinching, unmoved. And that's held up then as something that's greatly admired. To feel pain was an indication of weakness. Paul tells us he felt pain. He boasts of his weaknesses. So here Paul is boasting. He boasts of the efforts he made, the persecutions he experienced, the hardships he faced, the burdens he carried. The reluctance in his boasting, foolish, unspiritual, and worldly. The necessity of his boasting. The Corinthians were at a crossroads. The content of his boasting, the efforts he made, the persecutions he experienced, the hardships he faced, the burdens he carried. The fourth thing I want you to notice is the irony with his boasting. Now, we may still have a problem. You can see the reason why Paul boasted in the way that he did, but surely two wrongs don't make a right. And of course, that's true. But we have got to understand that Paul is not boasting in the usual way. These verses are full of irony. Irony was described by G.K. Chesterton as standing truth on its head to attract attention. And that's what Paul is doing. He stands boasting on its head. And the key verse to the whole passage is verse 30. If I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weaknesses. You see, if Paul was boasting in the normal way, we might expect him to say, as D.A. Carson suggests, I've established more churches, I've preached the gospel in more places and to more ethnic groups, I have traveled more miles, I've won more converts, I've written more books, I've raised more money, I've attended more councils, I have walked with God more fervently and seen more visions, I have commanded the greatest crowds and performed the most spectacular of miracles. But he doesn't. He could have, because all of those things were true, but instead he boasts of his weaknesses. Instead he speaks of his suffering, his persecution, his loss, his shame, and his defects. And even when you come into chapter 12, Paul's real boast is not being caught up to the third heaven, but it's the suffering that accompanied the thorn in the flesh. Those surpassing great revelations were the black backcloth on which the thorn was set, in order that it might appear all the more striking. It's the black velvet, to mix metaphors, it's the black velvet on which the diamond of the thorn is placed, so that its significance is all the more startling. And that's the key to understanding what Paul is doing here. He is being ironic. He is turning boasting on its head. In fact, it may be that he is parodying the eulogies of the ancient Roman world. For instance, Caesar Augustus penned his own eulogy in his own honor, setting out his own accomplishments. And it was inscribed on many monuments erected in various places throughout the empire in his honor. And that eulogy is very reminiscent of Paul's words, even down to the numbers. Once I did this, three times I did this, five times I did another. And Paul takes that eulogy, which every citizen of Rome would have been familiar with, and says, five times I received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one. Three times I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned. And in contrast to Caesar's eulogy, which spoke of accomplishment after accomplishment after accomplishment, Paul's eulogy speaks of weakness after weakness after weakness. And that's the whole point of the passage. If I must boast, I will boast, he says, verse 30, of the things that show my weakness. If you don't see the irony in the passage, you've missed the whole point of the passage. If you don't get that, then Paul is simply lapsing into worldly, egotistical, and shameless boasting. This is a carefully constructed catalogue calculated to turn the whole Greek and Roman attitude to boasting on its head and to burst the overinflated bubble of the egos of these false apostles. They boasted of their oratory, their miracles, their powers, their knowledge, their accomplishments. Paul boasted of his beatings, his stonings, his shipwrecks, his imprisonments, his hardships, his pastoral burden, and his thorn in the flesh. Weakness, weakness, weakness. If we don't grasp that, we have missed everything. The irony with his boasting. The reluctance in his boasting, foolish, unspiritual, and worldly. The necessity of his boasting. Now, these false prophets were coming into the church and seducing the Corinthians. The content of his boasting. Paul boasts of his weakness. The irony of his boasting. Paul turns boasting on its head. The fifth thing I want you to notice is the experience that shaped his boasting. Why does Paul boast of his weaknesses? What is he doing? What's this all about? Well, look at verse 31. The God and Father of the Lord Jesus, who is to be praised forever, knows that I am not lying. Paul, in using that formula, is indicating that he is about to introduce something of great significance, something of importance, something seriously noteworthy. And what follows in verses 32 and 33 takes most commentators by surprise, because what he says actually appears a little mundane, a little ordinary, a little pedestrian, a bit of an anticlimax. Look at verses 32 and 33. In Damascus, the governor under King Aretas had the city of the Damascenes guarded in order to arrest me, but I was lowered in a basket from a window in the wall and slipped through his hands. Now, what's all that about? Why does Paul introduce what seems to be a bit of trivial personal history at this point? Surely if he wanted to make a point about suffering, he could have better chosen his stoning at Lystra or his imprisonment in Philippi, all pre-Acts 20 experiences. After having our anticipation lifted by that solemn introduction, the God and Father of the Lord Jesus, who is to be praised forever, knows that I am not lying, we're frankly a little disappointed when we read of his escape from Damascus in a hamper. That is, until we understand what Paul is doing. Paul is referring back to an incident that happened right at the outset of his ministry. You remember he was on his way to Damascus to arrest Christians when he himself was arrested by the Lord on the Damascus Road. And he was led then into Damascus by the hand, like a lamb. The man who was once breathing out murderous threats was subdued by grace. After Ananias came to him, Paul began to preach, and the Jews, with the help of the Arab governor, conspired to kill him. The gates of the city were closed and were closely watched by both the Jews and the governor's troops when you put the Acts 9 and 2 Corinthians 12 accounts together. But at night, Paul was lowered from a window, hidden in what he indicates was a fish basket, a basket that was used to transport fish from the marketplace or from the sea to the marketplace in Damascus. Now, to Paul, that was a humiliating incident and highly significant, and served as an illustration of what his life, his ministry, and his calling would be. Indeed, the Lord had said to Ananias in Acts chapter 9, I will show him how much he must suffer in my name. And some commentators suggest that it was through this humiliating incident when he was lowered from the window that that revelation of future suffering in ministry came. Here is Saul heading to Damascus as a proud, arrogant, belligerent Pharisee, stubbornly and arrogantly opposed to the gospel. And after a divine encounter with Jesus, he leaves utterly transformed and passionately committed to the gospel and to the proclamation of the gospel that he once was so opposed to. But how does he leave? In a fish basket, at night, lowered through a window. There was no earthquake. There was no thunderstorm. There was no angelic intervention. They stuffed him into a basket and lowered him through the window in the middle of the night. And that incident was a revelation of suffering, an indication of what his calling and what his ministry would be, a revelation, as the Lord said to Ananias, how much Paul would have to suffer in his name. And that incident served as a paradigm, a pattern of what would follow of the ministry that he was about to undertake. He leaves the city in weakness. D.A. Carson says, the toast of high rabbinic circles with access to the highest officials in Jerusalem and Damascus slunk out of the city in a basket. And that was an indication of what his ministry of the gospel would be and how it would be fulfilled and what would be involved in weakness, in weakness, in weakness. And that is always God's way. He chooses the foolish things of this world to shame the wise. He chooses the weak things of this world to shame the strong. He chooses the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one can boast before him. You think of Moses. You think of Ehud. You think of Gideon. You think of Jephthah. You think of David. David, so insignificant that his father didn't even think it worthwhile to bring him in from the fields to be paraded before Samuel. Think of Elijah. Think of Jeremiah. Think of the 12 disciples. One commentator, tongue-in-cheek, imagines a memo that might have been sent to Jesus from a management consultant agency evaluating the 12 disciples. Thank you for submitting the resumes of the 12 men you have chosen for management positions in your new organization. All of them have now taken our battery of tests, and we have not only run the results through our computer, but also arranged personal interviews for each of them with our psychologist and vocational aptitude consultant. It is our opinion that most of your nominees are lacking in background, education, and vocational aptitude for the type of enterprise you are undertaking. They do not have team spirit. We would recommend that you continue your search for persons of experience in managerial ability and proven capability. Simon Peter is emotionally unstable, impetuous, and given to fits of temper. Andrew has absolutely no qualities of leadership. The two brothers, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, place personal interests above company loyalty. Thomas demonstrates a questioning attitude that could tend to undermine morale. We feel it is our duty to tell you that Matthew has been blacklisted by the Better Business Bureau of Jerusalem as unreliable. James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus definitely have radical leanings and both registered high on the manic depressive scale. One of the candidates, however, shows great potential. He is a man of ability and resourcefulness, meets well, has a keen business mind, and has contacts in high places. He is highly motivated, ambitious, and innovative. We have no hesitation in recommending Judas as your financial controller and right-hand man. Well, would you have chosen them? Men to pioneer a movement that would turn this world upside down and lay a foundation for future generations in the church. You see, the fact of the matter is that God's choice is not only unconditional, but at times it is highly unconventional. He chooses the weak things of the world to shame the strong. And those who are naturally able and gifted, like the Apostle Paul with his great intellect, are humbled and reduced to fleeing from Damascus in a fish basket so that they too might understand that God's work is advanced through weakness. And that's the great lesson that Paul discovered. As Hudson Taylor said, God is sufficient for God's work. God is sufficient for God's work. God chose me, he says, because I was weak enough. And in our celebrity-obsessed culture that admires the arrogant, the strong, the confident, the self-assured, the big personality, and the outrageous, that's a lesson that we need to rediscover at the beginning of the 21st century. that God's way of advancing God's work is through weakness. He delights to take a tinker from Bedford and make him into an author. He delights to take a cobbler from Leicester and make him into a Bible translator. He delights to take a shoe salesman from Chicago and make him into an evangelist. He delights to take a crofter from Scotland and make him into a professor of theology. Weakness, weakness, weakness. And that's what this fish basket incident is all about. It was designed to teach the Apostle Paul that it's not through power but through great weakness that God's work is advanced. So you complain, I'm insignificant. God says, good. I'm too reserved for this work. And God says, good. I'm not articulate enough. And God says, good. I'm not clever enough. I find sermon preparation so demanding. I just wish my mind was quicker and I could get the material together faster. And God says, good. My gifts are meager. And God says, good. My influence is small. And God says, good. My capacity for work is limited. And God says, good. I'm timid, shy, lacking in confidence. Good, good, good. You're exactly the person that I want, says God, because my work is advanced in weakness. This fish basket experience led the foundation for Paul's life and taught him that the work that God called him to was a work of humiliation, weakness, and frailty. The experience that shaped his boasting. The reluctance in his boasting, the necessity for his boasting, the content of his boasting, the irony in his boasting, the experience that shaped his boasting. Lastly, the conviction that gave rise to his boasting. Paul boasts of his weaknesses because he is convinced that God's way to advance God's work is through weakness. But how that happens and how it comes about is revealed to us in chapter 12. After boasting about his thorn in the flesh, his weakness, he not only reminds them of the sufficiency of God's grace, my grace is sufficient for you, but he reminds them that his power, that Christ's power, is made perfect in weakness. That it is in the extremity of our weakness that the power of Christ is most manifested. And verse 9 of chapter 12 is not simply a conclusion to the thorn in the flesh matter, but it's his conclusion to this whole section on boasting. It is the conviction that gives rise to his boasting. Now look at verse 9 carefully. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast. There's the word. That's the link. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, that Christ's power may rest on me. It is in and through our weaknesses that Christ's power is manifested. This was Paul's conviction that led him to boast in the way that he did, that it is in weakness, frailty, and insufficiency that Christ's power operates. And that shouldn't surprise us because that is the gospel. The power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes comes through a weak, bleeding Nazarene who, after suffering the indignity of 6 trials in one night and is repeatedly humiliated and beaten, is nailed to the cross and at the height of his agony cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? But out of that humiliation and weakness, a great multitude that no man can number is redeemed and brought safely into heaven. His power is made perfect in weakness. And the fact of the matter is that it's not that none are too weak to be of service to him, but some are too strong to be of use to him. This is what Jeffrey B. Wilson in his little commentary calls the grace principle of effective service. The grace principle of effective service. That it's in our weakness that the power of God, the power of Christ, is most apparent. You see that there in verse 9, that Christ's power might rest on me. Therefore, I will boast all the more about my weaknesses so that Christ's power might rest on me. Literally, might tempt me. Might tempt me. That word only appears here in the New Testament. In fact, it doesn't even appear in the Septuagint. It's a very special word. And most commentators see it as an allusion to the tabernacle, that just as God dwelt in the tent in the Old Testament, so in our weaknesses, he comes to dwell in us. I think there's maybe a bit of allusion to that, but I don't think that's a complete understanding of what Paul is saying. We are not the tent. In other words, his power doesn't come to reside in us as his tents, but the power itself is the tent. And he tempts us with power. The Amplified Bible puts it like this, that the power of Christ may pitch a tent over me and dwell upon me. It's a wonderful picture that in our weakness, that his power tempts us. So that anything that's good, that is accomplished, what do people see? They don't see us. But they see the power that covers us, the power of Christ that tends us, that rests and abides upon us. And we want them to see Christ, don't we? We want them to see his power. We don't want them to see us, strengths or weaknesses. We want them to see him. And it's in our weakness that the power of Christ covers us, that tends us. And that is why God places his gospel treasure in weak earthen vessels, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4, to show that the all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. And that's why Paul boasts here in the way that he does. Because it was his conviction that the dynamic power of God is not only unleashed in weakness, but it is revealed in weakness too. To quote Wilson, the self-sufficient must ever remain strangers to the power which is manifested only in conscious weakness. To reduce it to a mathematical formula, my weakness, his power equals his work. That's the principle. That was Paul's conviction. There's a wonderful line in the Canadian Victorian preacher A.B. Simpson's hymn, The Everlasting Arms. And the verse and the chorus read like this: underneath us, O high easy, we have not to mount on high, but to sink into his fullness and in trustful weakness lie. And we find our humbling failures save us from the strength that harms. We may feel, but underneath us are the everlasting arms. Our humbling failures save us from the strength that harms. There is a strength in ministry that is dangerous. There is a strength that harms. Self-reliance and depending on one's resources does more damage than good. It was when Paul was reduced to nothing that he discovered that God is everything. That's the conviction that gave rise to Paul's boasting, that God's power is made perfect in weakness. So here we stand at the brink of a new year, feeling very keenly our inadequacies, our shortcomings, our weakness, our inability even to create an anxious thought. You know, sometimes, don't you want to come out of the pulpit and you want to grab an unbeliever by the pals and you want to shake them and you want to say to them, don't you know that I'm speaking to you? This is for you. No, we can't. We can't even create an anxious thought. We're so weak when it comes to the work of God. But God would have us know that his work is advanced through his power in spite of human weakness. That was the great epiphany that I had in 2012. Not an epiphany to my eyes, but an epiphany to my heart. That God uses hands covered in peanut butter and jelly. And so we say with the Apostle Paul in that great paradoxical conclusion in verse 10, that is why for Christ's sake I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Isn't that a contradiction? When I am weak, then I am strong. I'm strong in his strength and the strength that he supplies. We said of William Grimshaw, when he was dying, his last words, just before he breathed his last, were these: "Here goes an unprofitable servant." And what more could we want than that? At the end of our lives, to say, "Here goes an unprofitable servant." As Robert Murray McShane says, would say, a weak, dying worm, who nevertheless was used by God, because God's strength is made perfect in weakness. Amen.